Welcome to your own health and fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss the personal politics of health. Rachel Carlson wrote her groundbreaking book, Warning the World About the Long-Term Health Effects of DDT, in 1962, 2 years before her death from cancer at 56. Since then, there have been other urgent warnings by naturalists and scientists, and still the layers of exposures mount up. There's discussion about allowable limits and parts per billion, but the newest reports show that there's no safe dose for toxins like lead and ionizing radiation. And what about children with their developing brains and smaller bodies? What about exposures in concert? How do these pollutants affect us when they come at us in combinations? And how is it that the new technologies and chemicals are being introduced without regard for the precautionary principle? Today we're joined by Dr. David O. Carpenter, whose long career has been devoted to the study of toxins and their health effects. Join us for a discussion this hour about public health and toxic waste. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett, Ph.D.
Thank you, Lena. The American College of Cardiology is holding its annual convention this week in New Orleans. A big deal at the convention is Innovation in Intervention, quote, an annual meeting for practicing cardiovascular interventionists, end quote, co-sponsored by the Society for Cardiovascular Angiography and Interventions. Intervention is the key word here. A lot of attention is being paid to stents. Stents are small mesh tubes made from metal that are inserted into arteries that feed your heart. They're inserted to repair an obstruction and prevent the obstruction from returning. Often, these things get inserted when someone is wheeled into the emergency room and the doctors find an artery that's partially blocked. They're also put in heart patients outside the emergency room if their doctor finds a blocked artery. The interventionists at the cardiology convention in New Orleans are talking about what kind of stent works best and what drugs should be used with them. One of the things they're talking about is whether plain metal stents are as good as the new improved stents impregnated with drugs to prevent complications. But what made it into the headlines today was a study that found no difference in survivability between stents plus drugs and drugs alone. In the business section, stent manufacturers were not alarmed by this news. They expect sales to continue at a brisk pace because the interventionists like stents so much. The logic for putting a stent in your arteries is simple. A heart attack is caused by a blocked coronary artery. A stent mechanically unblocks the artery and keeps it unblocked. Stents are not without their problems. For one, it's a foreign object in your body. Your body doesn't want it. So it will grow scar tissue around the stent. This causes the artery to get stiff and even clog up. That's where the drug-impregnated stents come in. A pharmacist friend told me the drugs are basically chemotherapy drugs that kill the scar tissue. Another problem is that stents can cause blood clots. Those clots could block the artery, or they could break loose and block some other artery, such as one in your brain that will cause a stroke. So patients who get stents must take anti-clotting drugs for anywhere from 6 months to 2 years. Another problem arises. Blood clots stop you from bleeding. If you cut yourself or have an internal hemorrhage from a fall, anti-clotting drugs will make it more difficult for your body to stop the bleeding. The most widely used anti-clotting drug for stents is Plavix. Made by Bristol-Myers Squibb, Plavix is the second best-selling drug in the world. In 2005, it raked in $5.9 billion. But I digress. The major problem with stents is that people don't need them. First, it looks like adding a stent to conventional drug therapy doesn't improve your chances. Second, the late Dr. Howard Wayne describes why stents don't work in his book, Do You Really Need Bypass Surgery? When an artery narrows, it is a gradual process. In response, your body grows blood vessels around the blockage to feed the tissue that's been cut off. Let's return to the logic of stents. As Dr. Wayne points out, and as many people we've had on this show have pointed out, blocked arteries don't cause heart attacks. So this whole stent enterprise is based on a false premise. I'm sure you remember what that means. False premise, false conclusion. Stents are a solution to something that's not a problem. Although lucrative, stents are technically useless. And the research presented at the cardiologist convention is showing at that. The interventionists just don't know what they're looking at. But you won't have control over that logic once you're wheeled into the emergency room with chest pains. Fear and institutional inertia and the hallowed place of stents in cardiac interventions will take over, and you will lose control. You can take control by resisting the fear, the fog of fear, and you can resist the interventionists and not let them take control from you. But most importantly, you can take control by taking care of your heart and your blood vessels so you won't get wheeled into the emergency room in the first place. For a copy of this editorial, go to our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, and go to our blog. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Jeff Fawcett, Ph.D., is an environmental economist, writer, and health educator who works with individuals. He co-produces this radio show and is editor of the Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to big box medicine. You can reach him again by going to our website, or you can call him at 707-874-1496. And now to our topic, public health and toxic waste, and to our guest, David O. Carpenter, received his undergraduate and medical education at Harvard University. He chose a career of research and public health rather than clinical practice. His early research focused on study of the brain, and this has led to much of his current focus on the effects of various environmental pollutants, which alter nervous system activity and function. After work at NIMH and DOD, he came to Albany as the director of the Wadsworth Laboratories of New York State Department of Health, and then became the founding dean of the School of Public Health, which is a joint venture of the University at Albany and the Department of Health. He currently is director of the Institute for Health in the Environment at the University at Albany. His current research includes animal studies of basic nerve cell function, study of the effects of both metals, especially lead and mercury, and organochlorine compounds, especially polychlorinated biphenyls and dioxins, on animal and human nervous system and immune systems. Also study of the relationship between residents near hazardous waste sites on human health. He has currently participated in a major study of contaminants in salmon and is knowledgeable on issues related to the presence of both organic and inorganic contaminants in fish and other foods. We're very, very lucky to have you as a guest today. Welcome, Dr. Carpenter.
Thank you very much.
How do you prefer to be addressed?
David.
David. Okay.
We don't need to be very formal.
Well, I appreciate that. I was glad that you sent your CV because it's extremely long, and it gives one a scope of how long you've been working on these issues and how many publications you've produced and books that are all scientific in nature. It would appear that not all scientists are as concerned as you are about toxins and their effects on health. Why is there still scientific resistance?
Well, I think that one of the problems is that a lot of the researchers in these fields study animals, and they're very reluctant to apply their results from animal research to the general public health. I'm a public health physician, and while I certainly wear the laboratory research hat as well, more so in the past than more recently, but I've always had the urge to apply my results to human biology and disease. And as my career has developed, I've done more and more of that. And I think that really is where we should all be going. Sometimes one's penalized for really vocalizing on the implications of the research you do. If you demonstrate something really is harmful to an animal's brain, and you know that people are exposed to it, it, in my judgment, is just wrong to keep quiet about that. And so increasingly, I've been applying the results that we have obtained in animal experiments and discussing the implications that those have for humans. And more of my research has now, in the last number of years, been on human populations where we can, at least to some degree, measure exposure to contaminants, even though we obviously can't control it very well.
A couple of things come to mind. One is that it seems to me that if looking at the result, you know, looking at the sorts of things that you're studying, there's no question scientifically that these various materials are causing problems and are disruptive to the environment and to the animals. And if that's so, how can any scientist really tell themselves that this is not affecting human beings? I mean, you're not really saying that they just don't think that if it's affecting animals, it's affecting us. That's not what you're saying, right?
No, it's not. That's not really what I'm saying. It's that scientists, by their very nature, are relatively cautious. And this goes back to the introductory comments about the precautionary principle. In research, we talk about 95% confidence limits. In our research, we want to have results that we're confident are correct at least to 95 out of 100 times.
And repeatable. Yeah.
And that's not a bad thing at all. I don't mean to criticize that.
No, I agree.
But it is often the case that when you study people where you cannot control exposure, where you've got a lot of genetic variation, where you've got exposures to many different things, it's much more difficult to get to that 95% confidence interval. And that's true even when you have animal studies that show beyond any shadow of doubt that there are harmful effects. And I think this is the area where the precautionary principle comes in, where the rigid scientist, the pure scientist, doesn't want to talk about anything where you don't have clearly statistically significant results in people. And, you know, I certainly use as the gold standard getting significant results in human studies as well. But I don't hesitate to speak about the implications of animal research when we don't have that level of significant information in people. But we do know that the agents harm behavior and function in animals.
Is it terribly cynical of me to think that there are that there's some economic censorship going on in for scientists?
Not at all. I mean, that's in fact, I think, a major factor in the caution that many scientists have.
Yeah, because I've observed this, where scientists who are the last standing person studying a particular thing and have some funding for their studying are very afraid to say anything that's clearly negative.
Well, and I think there is also a tendency among quality scientists to sort of look down their nose at people that go beyond the statistically significant results. Scientists don't really like activists. And, you know, to be called an activist is really a dirty word in many circles.
So you get ostracized for that.
You get penalized when you submit your grant applications, and mm-hmm. you get penalized when you submit articles for publication in peer-reviewed journals. Now, again, a certain amount of that is appropriate. When one publishes a scientific paper, it shouldn't be just an activist kind of paper. It should be quality science. But I think there also is an appropriate place for going beyond the data to discuss the implications, particularly those as are relevant to human health.
Well, and then, of course, nobody's screaming and yelling about the fact that industry pays for a lot of the research and, in fact, censors and limits its,
right.
Yeah, and changes the conclusions. You know, you have a study and it shows something fairly clearly, and then the conclusions don't match what the study found.
That's absolutely correct.
Why it's important to read more than abstracts. So given this atmosphere, how are public health institutions getting involved, if they are?
Well, I think that the last qualifier is a case in point. certainly there are public health institutions that are very involved, and there are individuals that stick their neck out and are not afraid of going beyond just the very well-defined and confirmed data. But there are many that are not. And, you know, again, this is one of these issues that revolves around the whole concept of the precautionary principle. One can question, you know, what level of evidence do you need before the precautionary principle should kick in? You have various levels of evidence. For the scientists, as I've already said, it's the 95 or the 99% confidence interval. The legal definition is, in most cases, more likely than not, which means if there's greater than a 50% chance that this is a reason for action. And I don't think within the public health community there's even any great consensus about what level of probability should trigger precaution.
Well, forgive me for interrupting you, but if I understand the precautionary principle correctly, substance is guilty until it's been proven innocent, not the other way around. I mean, the precautionary principle says if you introduce a new chemical, it is a potential toxin, and it should be proven safe before it's introduced.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. You know, in the real world,
yes,
that just doesn't happen.
I know. Yeah, well, and again, it's economic interests.
Well, as a matter of fact, I was part of a debate on these issues just a month or so ago. This happened to be around electromagnetic fields, which I know you've also touched on many occasions.
Oh, yes, and we will today too.
But the question really is, does the precautionary principle kick in only when it's a more likely than not issue? Especially in a case like that where we're not going to do away with electricity. The question is how much are we willing to inconvenience ourselves and pay to be protective, and what level of evidence for harm do you have to have? But that same debate applies to so many things. There's a different issue with new chemicals as compared to existing chemicals. The reality is we don't test either of them very, very systematically and very well. But many of the concerns that I have and that I've been studying relate to existing chemicals, things that have been in use for a long period of time already, and where there's a whole economic industry dependent on it, and not just economic industry, but households that are familiar with, use all the time, would be inconvenienced by giving them up. At what level of evidence of harm does this become something that should be reduced?
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, and we are on the phone with David O. Carpenter. And we're doing a show on public health and toxic waste. In fact, you've done an enormous amount of research, as I said, and you have shown the mechanisms for disruption of multiple physiologic systems and with exposure to various toxins. So referring to the two specific articles that you sent us on diabetes and heart disease, what are the clearest associations between toxic exposure and disease? And I would say that some of this is not just things in common use, it's also how toxins persist.
Well, that's absolutely right. This has gotten to be one of my current passions, the exploration of the role of environmental factors in causing these chronic diseases, the diseases that most of us in developed countries will die of. A lot of people have known for a long time that cancer is caused by environmental contaminants, and although I haven't done personally much on cancer recently, I think it's very important to note that the evidence is now becoming very clear that probably about 90% of all cancers are really due to some environmental exposure. That doesn't mean that our genetics doesn't have any effect, because different people's genetic predisposition will make them more vulnerable or less vulnerable to some environmental exposure. But cancer is just not a normal thing, and it in very few cases is entirely due to genes. So it's due to smoking. It's due to exposure to arsenic, to dioxins, to other chemicals that initiate the event. Well, so that's been sort of in the back of people's minds for a long time. But that's not really been the case for heart disease and diabetes. And yet heart disease and diabetes with cancer are the diseases that most of us will die of. Now, we've been approaching these studies really in three ways. Two of them are fairly well developed, and one we're just really beginning. I've been very involved in a series of studies where we've been looking, using large databases, looking at the diseases people are hospitalized for in relation to where they live, and specifically in relation to people's living near hazardous waste sites, where we have some knowledge of what the chemicals in those waste sites are. In New York, well, I should say first that I was motivated to start these studies because Health Canada did a series of reports on rates of hospitalization, rates of birth defects, and rates of cancer in 17 different communities in Ontario where there was known to be high levels of contamination. And they found just so many diseases to be elevated, diseases that I had never considered to be related to environmental exposures. And because I serve on the Science Advisory Board for the International Joint Commission, the U.S.-Canadian body that deals with our boundary waters, mainly the Great Lakes, I was asked to see if we could do something like something comparable in New York. And in fact, we have good databases. If you go into a hospital in New York State, when you're discharged, if you're an inpatient, when you're discharged, that hospital must report to the state health department every disease you have, up to 15 different diseases. And this is publicly accessible data without names and street addresses, but with the zip code in which the person lives, with their sex, their race, their age, the method of payment for the hospital expenses, and the zip code they live in. Now, we also have a very good database of hazardous waste sites. And the state of New York has about 900 identified hazardous waste sites. And for each of these, we know what the major contaminants are. We know the geographic location. So what we did was take that list of waste sites and we determined the zip code or the zip codes that they were in, because we only have the hospitalization data on the basis of zip codes. And we matched these two databases. And what we found for several diseases is a striking elevation in the frequency of hospitalization if you live in a zip code that contains persistent organic pollutants. And by persistent organic pollutants, I mean dioxins and furans, which are very toxic, PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, which are very common pollutant and are found in lots of these waste sites, and chlorinated pesticides like DDT. All of these compounds are important because they are very difficult to break down. We haven't made them for a long time, at least not intentionally, and they're present at high concentrations in the environment and also they're present in our bodies. What we were finding is about a 20% increase in the risk of being hospitalized for a heart attack if you live near one of these persistent organic contaminated sites, about a 20% greater chance you'll be hospitalized for diabetes if you live near one of these sites and if you live in a zip code that doesn't have a hazardous waste site. And then we've used sort of as our control site the people that live along the Hudson River. Now, you know, I'm certainly not saying that environmental exposures are the only factors that increased risk of these diseases. We've known for a long time that smoking cigarettes is a risk factor for heart disease and less so for diabetes. A bad diet, getting little exercise, these are risk factors. Well, the people, the other major risk factor is poverty. Poor people are more ill than wealthy people. So the socioeconomic status is a very important confounder. Well, with our database information, we don't know anything about the individual. We only know where they live and sex and age and race. But there is a database that gives statistics for different geographical areas, and we've used that. That's called the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. And the sides of the Hudson River that are contaminated with PCBs happen to be very beautiful places to live. Average income is greater than it is in the rest of the state. That usually corresponds with a higher level of education, which corresponds with better diet, more exercise, less smoking. And using this behavioral risk factor surveillance system, we could document that the people along the Hudson in general live healthier lifestyles. And yet their rates of having a heart attack were 39% greater, not just 20% as it was for the full state, mm-hmm. but 39% greater than people living in other parts of the state that were not near a waste site. So our conclusion from these studies is that while we have very poor exposure assessment, we're only looking at where the people live by zip code in relation to contaminated sites, but this is consistent with living near these waste sites posing a risk of exposure and exposure causing disease. Well, the next question is how do people get exposed if our hypothesis is correct? These compounds are usually thought of getting into people primarily from eating contaminated fish, although you get some of these compounds from having a Big Mac or almost any kind of animal fat. But the people that go fishing in contaminated waters are not defined by where they live, so we don't think that can be the route of exposure. And the hypothesis that we're pursuing, certainly not confirmed yet, but we believe that we hypothesize that these compounds are semi-volatile, that is, they mm-hmm. go into the air, and that if you live near the contaminated site, you breathe them in.
Right.
And we all breathe all the time. We can't control that. And this is a route of exposure that has not been studied very much, but we have increasing evidence that it's important. Now, so those studies, and we have papers on stroke, on hypertension, on heart disease, on diabetes, on bronchitis and respiratory infections, and actually just right now when you called me, I'm working on a publication looking at asthma and respiratory infections in children in relation to where they live, proceedings of a meeting that I attended in Munich last fall. But for all of those studies are limited by this poor exposure assessment. And we have fortunately had comparable studies with a Native American group in northern New York State that we've worked with for a number of years where we can obtain blood samples. We can measure their levels of PCBs and pesticides. We can measure their fasting glucose level, which is obviously how one diagnosis diabetes. We can measure their serum cholesterol and total lipid levels, which are the major risk factors for heart disease. We can measure their thyroid hormones, their sex hormones, their liver enzymes, a variety of these parameters that may not be the actual disease, but they are indicators of disease. And we are confirming in those populations the results that we find in this larger database work where our exposure assessment is poor. So that's the kind of thing that I like to do. Having moved now primarily to human studies, and when you can look at large populations, you get information, but it has to be considered hypothesis generating. And then to really prove what you think is the explanation for these larger studies, you need to have a better exposure assessment than we have had until now.
We're going to need to take a brief musical break. I just wanted to comment briefly on what you said about cancer being primarily genetic. I have had a couple of very interesting...
Primarily not genetic.
Oh, you said not. Okay, well, that
Never mind.
As Gilda Radner used to say.
Genetic susceptibility is important, but
right.
It's primarily
no, I agree. Not genetic
exposure.
Right.
For the
Thank you.
Event.
Yeah, I was going to say just the work of Stanislav Brzezinski, you know, who has
yes.
learned how to turn on and off these variants, these genetic variants.
Yes.
Great. Well, then we're in agreement. When we come back from break, what I want to talk to you about is the possibility that in these higher socioeconomic status people, whether what we might be looking at is an interesting combination of pollutants and other sources of toxins like EMFs and RFRs and things like that. So we're going to take a brief musical break. This is Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, Your Own Health and Fitness. We're on the phone with David O. Carpenter from Albany University. We're doing a show called Public Health and Toxic Waste. If you please would stay with us, we'll have more in just a moment. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett. We are on the phone today with David O. Carpenter talking about public health and toxic waste. If you missed parts of today's show and want to get a want to listen to it actually all week long, you can go to our website to do that, yourownhealthandfitness.org. You can also go to the website to find information on the Progressive Health Observer and Radio on Demand, where you can download our archives and articles. Or you can call us at 707-874-2772 or Dr. Fawcett at 707-874-1496. David, I don't. Is there a there's if one Googles David O. Carpenter, you will find lots and lots of material and studies. Is there any one particular place that you want interested listeners to go to download any studies or anything?
Well, they can certainly Google and find publications. We also have a website that is set up by my institute. It doesn't have everything on it, but it has a number of the recent press releases and so forth. That's www.albany.edu/IHE for Institute for Health and the Environment.
Okay. So as we were picking up from what you were discussing before break, I was positing the possibility that one of the reasons that you're seeing people who have a better income having still this extremely high risk when they're exposed to environmental pollutants, might this be this issue of combining, like many, many people in the upper socioeconomic strata have, for instance, wireless internet now in their houses. They're doing wireless stuff. They're using cell phones. They have offices packed with electronic equipment with AC adapters sitting close to their bodies. Some of them may be sitting behind a computer and getting irradiated by the back of the computer. So you've got this combination of radiation of various types, including electromagnetic fields. And we're about to do a show with Cindy Sage on the BlackBerry.
Yes.
Which is going to be just kind of a first hit at people hearing about the amount of EMF that's being released by these things. So might that be confounding this?
Well, absolutely. The numbers of things that we are exposed to all the time that we don't know about, things that are in hand lotion, in cosmetics, certainly the EMFs that come from all sorts of different appliances. If you can turn on the radio or receive a TV signal or use your cell phone, it means you're in an environment that's full of these forms of of non-ionizing radiation. Now, the chemicals, the radiation, the EMFs, the radio frequencies, all of these things are controversial in the sense that we don't really know the degree of hazard, and there's some question as to whether there is a hazard, but we certainly do not know that they are safe. The new things on the block that are at least are beginning to get to the awareness of people are household cleaning products. If you use bleach, if you use ammonia, particularly if you mix them, you can kill yourself. You know, we just have taken very casually the use of a variety of things. We spray our house with pesticides because we see an ant and freak out about the little ant. I hosted a radio show until very recently and interviewed one scientist who was asking the question, where do people get exposed to pesticides? And his assumption going into the study was it was all on the broccoli that they eat.
Mm.
No, it wasn't. About 85% of their pesticide exposure mm-hmm. was from breathing in mm-hmm. pesticides that were sprayed around the house.
Well, and they're also in buildings that people go to. If you live in an apartment building, they spray, hopefully not inside, but very often inside, and health clubs.
Well, in my school, in the School of Public Health, the people still spray pesticides. It's just really outrageous. This happens in elementary schools and daycares. And, you know, I think it's really not necessary. It's not only not necessary, it's dangerous. But the public is really oblivious to this fact for the most part. And there is fortunately now a real movement toward green buildings. And green buildings are buildings that not only have good lighting, good ventilation, but where one doesn't use dangerous cleaning products, doesn't use pesticides, and finds other ways of controlling. I mean, nobody wants to have roaches and ants and other things around, rodents. But you don't need to use things that are going to harm people in order to control these pests.
No, there's integrated pest management programs, and there are borates, which is similar to borax,
right,
which are very good for controlling critters. One of the ways that exposure to toxins, I believe, and I'd like you to tell me if this is so, affect human beings in a way that makes them more likely to get ill is that it may be interfering with protective nutrient pathways and particularly neurotransmitters, judging from the number of studies you've done on what happens in the brain and all the neuropathways and stuff. Have you done studies to see whether nutrients are actually protective? For instance, I know that your detoxification pathways can be screwed up, if I can say that on the air, by a DNA variant that interferes with folic acid absorption.
Yes.
So that's part of your detoxification pathway. Is that part of the damage that we're seeing from these pollutants?
Well, you raised several points there, and, you know, obviously I have not studied all of them. Let me just describe a couple that I have studied. I am very currently interested in and involved in the debate about the dangers of the contaminants in fish that we eat, and those contaminants are particularly PCBs, the whole organochlorine family, and methylmercury, versus the benefits, the good things from the omega-3 fatty acids, the good fats that that we as humans cannot synthesize. And there's been a lot of debate about this. I've gotten involved with this primarily because of the studies we've done on contaminants in salmon. But there's an article coming out almost every other week, one saying that you shouldn't eat fish because they're very dangerous because of the contaminants. The next one saying you should eat more fish because the good fatty acids are important for brain development and they protect against heart disease. And I think the answer is that there's some merit to both sides of that argument.
Yeah, both things can be true.
That's right. But the point is, one doesn't have to eat a contaminated fish to get the healthy omega-3 fatty acids.
Yeah, and increasingly, supplement companies who are producing omega-3 fatty acids are distilling them so that the contaminants are removed.
That's absolutely right. And I had this interesting experience of visiting my internist and being advised to start taking fish oil supplements because my triglycerides were a little high. And I gave him a lecture about how terrible fish oil was because it was full of contaminants, but then began to think on the way home that maybe I didn't know what was in fish oil supplements. And so I stopped at the local health food store and bought 20 different varieties of fish oil capsules and had them analyzed in our lab for PCBs and DDT and hexachlorobenzene, and found there were almost none in any of them. There was only one sample that had any significant amount, that, of course, being the only one that advertised on the label PCB-free, and it wasn't. But it's true that the supplements are both distilled and treated with activated charcoal, and most of the contaminants are removed.
My observation from just from my practice working with individuals as a health educator is that triglycerides go up not so much in relationship to the fat that you're eating or the type of fat, but the amount of carbohydrates and sugars.
Yes.
So that's a big misunderstanding. And also, one of the slippery slopes about saturated fat is that saturated fat is very protective to the immune system. Various researchers who have studied this very carefully, like Ufi Ravenskov, who's a PhD MD, who's done research in this, you know, cholesterol is not a fatty, it's a waxy substance, and it carries antioxidants and sort of does tend to go up under stress and inflammation. So it could increase in an inflammatory state when somebody if somebody has been exposed to a lot of pollutants and their body is kind of the homeostasis suddenly is very clumsy, that could be viewed as an inflammatory state. And so the cholesterol level may go up as a
right.
stressor there. But the animal fats, the saturated fats, although truly, industrially raised animals are going to have an enormous amount of pollutants in their fat. You could argue that grass-raised animals also potentially have pollutants in them, because how much can we protect the air? And, you know, it depends on where your grass-fed animals are being raised. If it's the Central Valley, be afraid, be very afraid sort of thing. But in fact, there's this kind of balance beam going on between the consumption of foods that are nutrient dense and provide activation of not only detoxification pathways, but also provide the right types of fats and the right balances so that you can absorb and utilize vitamins. Because one of the things that people sort of come at me with is food-based vitamin versus pharmaceutical grade, and really the issue is more what you're eating in relationship to your vitamins will predict whether or not they'll be absorbed and utilized correctly.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. And it's, you know, the reality is that we eat too much, period.
That's true, too.
Too much sugar, too much fat. And the idea that we think we can supplement our bad diet with other nutrients and balance it out just is not correct.
No, it has to be a whole program. I'd like to get you to talk. Well, let me just quickly say that you're listening to an interview with David O. Carpenter. I'm Lena Berman. Jeff Fawcett is here being very silent in the background, although he's an environmental economist. I know he has questions. He's just shaking his head and saying, no, go ahead. I'd like you to talk some more about electromagnetic fields and what we do know, because honestly, you've written hundreds and hundreds of papers, and maybe, I don't know, I didn't count all the books, but it looks like maybe 60 books or something. So
no, I don't think it's quite
not,
that.
Not so, it's a long list. So I have to think that you know something about this, and I'd like you to tell us what you do know, because people are still kind of mixed up about what to think.
Well, let me just tell you first how I got involved in electromagnetic fields. When I first came to New York in 1980 as the director of the laboratory in the health department, 2 weeks before I arrived, there had been a controversy between our state power authority and our state public service commission about whether or not there were health effects from power line fields. And as the new guy on the block that didn't have a full plate already, I was given the responsibility of administering a $5 million program, relatively similar to the one that you've had in California, to evaluate whether or not there were health effects from power line fields. And at that time, there was really very little information. There was this one striking report from Denver that indicated there was an elevated risk of cancer in children if they lived in a home that had high magnetic fields in the home. Well, we didn't really believe that report, but it was the most serious allegation. And therefore, as part of our research program, we funded a replication of that study in Denver and basically confirmed the original result. During that period of about 7 years when I was administering the program, I wasn't in a position of making comments on the issue, but after it was over, I became sort of the official spokesperson for New York State on issues of EMF, especially power line fields. And as I indicated, our results didn't really prove anything, but they were consistent with the conclusion that that children exposed to high levels of magnetic fields had a greater risk of cancer. Now, it's interesting to sort of look at the field since that time. Our study ended in 1987, which is quite a while ago, 20 years ago. But the debate and the level of evidence really is about the same today, 20 years later. There have been a number of studies of residential exposure of children to magnetic fields, and most of them are positive. They show that there is a doubling or tripling of the risk of developing leukemia. The problem has been that nobody has been able to consistently show that animals exposed to magnetic fields of the same magnitude get cancer. And this is just the opposite of the information we have for most chemicals. Usually with chemicals, we have clear information in animals, and we extrapolate to people. In the case of EMF, we have information that people get cancer, but we can't get the cancer in the animals. And I'm constantly surprised that when the evidence is cancer in children in relation to their exposure to magnetic fields, that the scientific community basically scoffs at this because of the fact they can't replicate that study in animals. Now, magnetic fields, and really all EMF, is a complex issue because we don't quite know the mechanisms in any case, but the currents that are induced by these fields are not the same if you're a four-legged animal or if you're a two-legged animal. It may not be the currents that are causative, but that's what most people think. Now, the issues today, again, we've had more studies by various groups. There is suggestive evidence, but there's not a mechanistic explanation. And that makes people reluctant to take any kind of significant action. The problem is really much more complicated and much less clear when we talk about radio frequency fields, the cell phone frequencies, the radio, the television transmission frequencies.
So say something about that.
There just is, there's much less information. There's been much less study. Because of the uncertainty on the 60 hertz fields, the funding for additional research has just almost disappeared. The way I describe the situation is there is absolutely no evidence that these fields are safe. There is not conclusive proof that they're dangerous, but there's a lot of smoke. And when there's a lot of smoke, there's usually a fire.
Yeah, the industry has made it very difficult for people to continue studying. They're shutting a lot of people down, even in Europe. And the Telecommunications Act in this country prevents neighborhoods and municipalities from disputing new technology. No, well, but they can't dispute it on the basis of health.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. So there's the industry knows that there's a problem, or they wouldn't be defending themselves this way. And I think that, again, as I've said a few times during the show, what we're looking at in terms of disruption is occurring through a combination of layered effects of these various insults happening in concert.
Well, I totally agree with that. But the fact is that the industry, with the compliance of the U.S. government, has really shut down the ability of individuals to fight the placement of a cell phone tire on the basis of health effects. I've recently been part of an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court around the issue. The FCC is proposing to increase the frequency for cell phone usage. A higher frequency is more energy, and on that basis alone, one would expect that that would be more dangerous. The question, this was a woman in New York City who brought a suit to at least require the FCC to do an environmental impact statement before they approve the use of this higher frequency for communication.
Yeah, it's...
The Supreme Court refused to hear that case.
Jeez. Well, the other ominous thing is that when I've interviewed experts, and we have, if people go to our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, and go to either radiation or EMF or RFR, it'll all go to the same page where we have all this information on various forms of radiation and electromagnetic fields. But we've done many shows with many very esteemed experts, and one of the things that's very ominous is the constant exposure from wireless. And what's happening now is that cities are opting to cover their municipalities in wireless technologies. And this, combined with the fact that individual houses now have wireless, and this is microwave, and susceptible individuals exposed to it feel as if they're being microwaved. They feel hot, their skin gets red, they get thirsty, and it is upwards of 20% of the population at this point who are electrosensitive, and the rates are going up because of the preponderance of the technology. So it's getting very difficult for anybody to go anywhere without it. I mean, I remember at one point calling a campground, because all the hotels have it, and I can't sleep when it's on, and the campground had it. So,
well, and there just is no longer anyone that's not exposed.
It's getting very hard. Yeah, we live in the woods, so we have less exposure, but it's getting very, very difficult to avoid.
If you can receive a radio station, a TV station,
yes,
you're not unexposed.
Well, and now the FCC is being very generous, and it's releasing all these low-powered FM stations to little activist communities, and communities are putting up antennas on their property without realizing that they're adding another exposure to the exposure they already have. In a large municipality, your transmitter is going to be far from right next to your house, and if you do it on your own property in a small area, you're adding more layers, and that seems to be the problem, is the additional layers. So before we completely run out of time, can you offer some advice to listeners in terms of not only, I mean, obvious things, you know, you don't, as you said, don't use pesticides in your house, avoid chemicals where you can, don't add to the load, don't smoke, eat carefully, you know, exercise, yada, yada. But what about, you know, things like how to find out if you're living on a toxic site? What about, from your perspective as a public health person, what do you see as the consumer's role? I mean, my sense is that this is only going to get turned around by consumers making noise, but what is your advice?
Well, I certainly would agree with that last statement. This only is going to be turned around by people understanding the risks that they're exposed to and really getting on the horn and letting other people know about it, let their representatives in Congress know about it, and speak loudly, because it really is our government is responsive to the pressure that comes from the public. But if without a loud voice from the public, then sources that have financial interests are going to dominate in the decision making. Now, I think that knowledge is really the key. Knowledge of where the exposures come from. This is one of the things we try to do within the communities we work with. Empower the communities with some level of knowledge. You know, it isn't just the waste site. It's the chemicals that people bring into their own homes. It's the things they put on their own body. Those you have very much total control about. At a slightly bigger level, the waste sites, where you choose to live, a lot of these exposures are determined by local officials, locally elected mm-hmm. governments.
Mm-hmm.
The school board is a very important organization because the school board is going to set policies for what your kids are exposed to in schools. People get overwhelmed and feel that they can't do anything. Well, that's really not true. Each person has some control over their own environment. We don't have total control, of course. But my advice is for people to start exercising control over those things they can control themselves.
So working locally.
Working locally. And then mobilizing the community to influence the political process, first locally, then statewide, then federally, then internationally. And only when we get people informed about the hazards and speaking up about them and working together will we be able to change things.
Well, it's very important that you're doing the work that you're doing, and I'm so happy to know you and to know about your work. I want to really thank you for what you're doing on behalf of the public. It's very important work.
Well, thank you.
And with all the resistance out there. Again, can you give out your website for the university?
It's www.albany.edu/IHE.
And we'll put that on our website. David O. Carpenter, thank you again so much for this time with us.
My pleasure.
Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or you want a CD copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows, information about guests, the Progressive Health Observer, and Radio on Demand, where you can download archives and articles, go to the website, yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness and KPFA-FM, and you can listen to the show, a full-hour version of it, on our website all week long. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.